You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Most people tend to follow a certain routine and set of rituals throughout the day, whether we begin by hopping in the shower or putting on a pot of coffee. Ernest Hemingway would rise with the sun every morning to write, no matter how late he had been partying the night before. His son remarked that he seemed to be immune from hangovers. On the other hand, Nikola Tesla wouldn't arrive at his office until noon, and then he'd shut the curtains and work in the dark. In Daily Rituals, How Artists Work, Mason Curry chronicles the routines of some of the world's most creative minds and asks, how is it that some of us can barely manage to stay on top of our laundry while others manage to write plays, compose operas, or paint landscapes? The book is published by Knopf. I'm very pleased that it has brought Mason Curry to our show today. Hello.
Thank you for having me.
And we also invite our listeners to join the conversation. If you have a ritual that helps you get your work done, you can let us know by giving us a call at 212-433-9692. You can also write us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook and Twitter, where my handle is at Leonard Lopate. So, Mason, didn't this book grow out of a blog that you started back in 2007 called Daily Routines? What had gotten you interested in the daily habits of famous people in the first place?
I think I've always been a routine loving person in my own life. I find if I don't have an established daily routine that I tend to get moody and anxious. And also as someone who's always wanted to be a writer, I feel like if I could just find the right daily routine, the one where I could get the writing time in every day, that would kind of be the secret. So I've always been fascinated by these stories.
And what was the initial response to the blog?
The very initial response was that just a few of my friends and coworkers read it and they liked it, but I think I had just a handful of readers, and then there was a moment where it got linked to from a lot of places and it kind of had a moment of publicity.
And then took off.
And then led to the book, yeah.
But had you started writing the blog with the idea that a book might be somewhere down the road?
No, honestly, no. I did it as a hobby, as a way of kind of keeping track of these anecdotes and stories for my own enjoyment and for other people's. And I had kind of thought maybe it could be a magazine article someday. And then when the idea of a book came along, obviously I was thrilled. And it's true. There's so many of these stories that you could fill even a bigger book than this one.
Well, how do you find the stories? Is there a lot of information out there? Do you Google Ernest Hemingway, what he did to get going in the morning?
For the blog, that's kind of how I started. I was doing some Google searches. You know, the Paris Review has a wonderful archive of author interviews. But for the book, I really tried to dig up the very best material I could find, and that was a process of combing through biographies and collections of letters and diaries and interviews and, you know, trying to find kind of these great nuggets of information.
You detail the routines of 161 people in this book, covering a broad spectrum of creative minds from artists to scientists. Then you had to decide which ones you would include.
Yeah.
Was it the best stories or the most famous ones?
It was the best stories. I mean, my initial idea was to get people who were kind of the greats of the arts and culture over the last few hundred years, and names that people would recognize, because it's more fun to know the mundane details of people's lives if they are, you know, famous people in their fields.
Well, aren't authors asked about their writing process quite often? Are they easier to research than others?
Yeah, writers were by far the easiest, and I had to kind of resist including more writers because there is, as you say, so much information about how many words a day they do and what time they get up and how many cups of coffee they drink. It was a little more challenging to find the same kind of information for painters and composers and other artists.
Well, in the case of a painter, you have to get up and just set up. You get the canvas or whatever you're working on, get the paints out. It's not so much a ritual. It's just simply getting your stuff in order, the same with a number of other things. But I would imagine composers would have the same sorts of various rituals as writers. I'm not sure about scientists, but if you're a theoretical scientist, aren't you pretty much going through the same kind of creative process?
I think often that's true. Yeah, that's what I found. And as you mentioned, I think composers and writers have a lot in common. There's a very similar kind of process. And painters, by contrast, You know, I think it's a different kind of creativity. So many painters remark on how they get in front of the canvas and then the hours fly by and they don't know where the time goes. Well, by contrast, so many writers and composers talk about the torture of disciplining themselves to stay at the desk for even a couple hours. And so many of their rituals are about, you know, sticking to it. Whereas painters, it's more about breaking off from it at some point.
Of all the people you researched, were there some who really you thought had the weirdest or the most convoluted routines?
There are some pretty weird ones in there, yeah. Balzac, the famous French writer, had a very elaborate and punishing schedule. He would eat dinner at 6 in the evening and then go to sleep. And then at 1 in the morning, he would get up and write for 7 hours or 7.5 hours until like 9 in the morning. And then he would let himself have a 90-minute nap, and then he'd go back to work for another 8 hours. And then there was sort of a 2-hour period to take a bath and take a walk, and then he'd begin the thing all over again. And while he was at it, he would drink cup after cup of strong black coffee, as many as 50 cups a day, according to one estimate.
One of the ones that grabbed my fancy years ago was the one that the German poet Friedrich Schiller had.
Yeah, Schiller said that he kept a drawer full of rotting apples in his workroom because he needed their decaying smell in order to feel the urge to write.
Don't some of the legendary rituals turn out not to be true? We mentioned Hemingway, his routine, but there was this whole business about his sharpened pencils.
Yeah, the legend about Hemingway is that he had to sharpen 20 number 2 pencils before he could begin writing. But in an interview with the Paris Review, he said that that's not true, that he'd never even owned 20 pencils at one time.
Did you notice any similarities among the people that you wrote about?
There are a lot of early risers and night owls. I think so many creative people found that they had to get up early before everyone else was awake or stay up when everyone else was asleep, and that was the only time that they could avoid the distractions and really focus on their work.
On the other hand, some people had contempt for people who had different kinds of rituals. Auden felt that anybody who worked at night was, what, like Hitler?
His quote is that only the Hitlers of the world work at night. No honest artist does. But, of course, Auden was a diehard morning person, so he was biased.
He had other things that he did that might surprise people. He thought of drugs as labor-saving devices in his mental kitchen.
Yeah, he took a daily dose of amphetamines the way that many people take a daily multivitamin. And, before I started researching the book, I was aware of people like Hunter S. Thompson and Jack Kerouac who took amphetamines as a way to fuel these writing binges. But researching the book, I found several people like Auden who used amphetamines in a much more methodical and even kind of boring way as a way to just sort of crank out the work and keep themselves focused.
And then Proust also took drugs. That surprised me.
Yeah, he smoked a sort of opium powder that he thought relieved his chronic asthma. I'm not sure how strong it was as far as opium goes.
But you would have thought it would be a soporific and it would have prevented him from turning out as many words as he did.
Yeah, you would think that. I know. I mean, his whole lifestyle doesn't seem very conducive to getting work done. He wrote, reclining in bed so that he was just barely, his head was just barely propped up by a few pillows and his arm would become cramped after only a few, few minutes.
And then Ayn Rand, who suffered from chronic fatigue, took Benzedrine?
Yeah, she's another one who took amphetamines in a pretty methodical way. She went to a doctor because she was suffering from fatigue and sluggishness, and she had spent years planning the first third of The Fountainhead, which would become her breakthrough work, of course. And after the Benzedrine prescription, she was able to write a chapter a week. But ultimately, it caused a whole host of side effects, and I'm not necessarily advocating amphetamine use.
Charlie Parker, who's not listed here because he was a musician who showed up when he showed up, but he wrote at one point after he had gotten clean that he had always thought that that the drugs helped him be more creative, and it was only after he had gone clean that he realized that they actually had a negative effect on his work, listening to his recordings. Unfortunately, the drugs caught up with him again, and he died at 35. When they did the autopsy, the doctors thought that he was in his 50s or 60s. Mm. The drugs had so ravaged him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
go ahead.
There's a similar Fitzgerald had a similar realization. He felt that alcohol was, you know, kind of essential to his creative process. But in a letter to his editor about the book Tender Is the Night, he kind of admitted that, you know, alcohol had interfered with the planning and execution of the novel.
My guest is Mason Curry, whose writing has appeared in Slate, Metropolis, print, and, of course, his own blog. And now there's a book called Daily Rituals, How Artists Work I guess that's it, right? Is that the subtitle?
That's the subtitle,
You just have it on your cover twice, so I got a little confused there. The book is filled with many intimate and surprising details, like the fact that Frank Lloyd Wright was a major procrastinator.
Yeah, his colleagues were kind of constantly, annoyed and terrified by his habit of putting things off to the last second. And for Falling Water, his most famous residence, he didn't begin the drawings until the client called to say that he was getting in the car and would be there in about 2 hours. So, but he said he had to have the entire design worked out in his head before he could commit it to paper. And there are some other artists who said similar things. It was like the actual execution was kind of an afterthought.
That recently there was a book on the value of procrastination, because so many writers put off doing what they had to do, and then they'd get their best ideas. Gertrude Stein, another case?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems that a lot of writers need to kind of work themselves up into a sort of frenzy or a state of anxiety where they can finally, force themselves to get down to work.
So what did Stein do to get herself going finally?
Stein's interesting because she said that she never wrote for much more than 30 minutes a day, and that, for her that was enough, that if you wrote for 30 minutes a day, that over time that added up. And I mean, her life, there's a great Talk of the Town profile that paints a sort of comical portrait of her life in the south of France with her partner, Alice B. Toklas, and how her partner would kind of like drive her out into the countryside and set up a chair in the grass and sit Gertrude Stein down with a piece of paper. And there would be sort of like a few cows in her line of sight, and that was the ideal setting for her work.
And then she'd finally get going.
Mm-hmm.
One of the oddest stories is Jane Austen's. She had a lot of complicated routines.
Well, Jane Austen is interesting because she didn't have the kind of privacy that a contemporary writer could expect. She lived in a home with her mother and her sister and a close friend, and they had servants and a constant stream of visitors. And so she would write in the sitting room while her mom and sister were sewing quietly nearby on these little scraps of paper. And when visitors showed up, she would kind of shove the scraps of paper under some sewing and kind of pretend to join the family in sewing, because it was kind of a secretive activity.
And she didn't want them to get rid of the squeaky door.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there was a squeaky door hinge, and that's how she knew that someone was coming. And so she didn't let them fix that.
We know there are a lot of artists who listen to this show, and if you are one of them or somebody else who is engaged in some kind of creative process and have rituals, we would love to hear from you. Our number here is 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. You can also write us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. I'm talking with Mason Curry. His book, Daily Rituals, How Artists Work, it is published by Knopf. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Mason Curry, who has written a book called Daily Rituals, How Artists Work. It's published by Knopf. I guess that you've culled from your blog.
A little bit, yeah. The blog had about, I think, 75 entries total, and maybe 25 of those ended up in the book, although the versions in the book are considerably fleshed out and kind of better presented. The blog was really a hobby for me, and when I started the book, I kind of put the blog on hold so I could focus on the kind of the best material.
It seems to me that there are certain kinds of patterns here. There are the people who procrastinate, who really have to really get themselves to work. And then there are the workaholics. You mentioned Balzac. Another one is Alexander Graham Bell.
Yeah. Alexander Graham Bell, when he was an assistant in Thomas Edison's you know, workshop, Edison marveled that he was the hardest working assistant he'd ever have. He would, you know, come in at 10 a.m. in the morning and then leave at, I think, you know, noon the following day, you know, more than 24 hours of work at a stretch. And later when he was married, his wife was, you know, frustrated by his working habits and kind of tried to force him to knock off work in the evening and have some family time. And it was really difficult for him. There's sort of a letter where he talks about how hard it was for him to resist this urge to kind of go off on these flights of hours and hours of work. And that comes up over and over in the book. There are so many people who say that, you know, it's the hardest thing for them not to work and that they can't imagine their lives without work.
Well, just because you have stopped working doesn't mean your mind isn't still going on and thinking about the things that you were thinking about while you were working.
That's very true. Yeah, and another common theme in the book is distracted artists at the dining room table. You know, so many stories about, you know, Sigmund Freud would come in to eat dinner with his family and everyone would, you know, he'd be so distracted and moody and in his own head that if there were guests present, they kind of were flummoxed and had to make conversation with his wife.
I had dinner with a couple where the husband was a writer, and suddenly he sort of looked away, and she said, ah, he's thinking about how he can incorporate this conversation into something he's about to write.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, like you say, they're sort of always at work, or it's always in the back of their mind.
One of the more interesting examples here is Louis Armstrong, who had a really elaborate group of rituals.
Yeah, he had sort of an elaborate pre- and post-show ritual, and a lot of it involved these kind of home remedies that he had adopted over the years. He had a special salve made from Germany that he would use on his lips before the show, and then after the show, a big part of his routine was using this very potent herbal laxative. And
Swiss Chris,
which is still, I think, on the market today. And he swore by it and even had a postcard printed up for his friends kind of advocating its use.
He also smoked grass every day, didn't he?
Yeah, he openly smoked pot. You know, he considered that part of his creative process.
Let's take a couple of calls. Peter, hi, you're on the air. Peter from NIAC.
Yeah, I kind of had to try to force myself into a daily ritual about a year and a half ago. I built a couple of little chairs, and I put a coat of paint on them every single day for a whole year to force myself into having a paintbrush in my hand.
And then you went to work on your paintings?
Well, that too, yes. But the chairs themselves became a project of their own, mm-hmm. One of which I cut in half. They were pretty cool. But I just... To get myself going every day, I would just put a coat of paint on these every single day for a whole year. And I've now embarked on another similar project I'm a little less militant about.
Thank you for calling us.
Sure.
Mindy from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi.
What do you do?
Well, when I was writing my memoir about a really difficult period in my adolescence in the 1960s, it was really difficult for me to get myself to sit down because it was just, you know, kind of overwhelming to revisit that time. So every morning for the 2 years that I was writing the book, I would put on music from the 60s. I actually got a friend bought me a special stereo for my writing area in my bedroom, and I would just put on music from that period, and that's all that I listened to for more than 2 years, and it immediately transported me back into that time, so that I was there, and I thought of it as a kind of self-hypnosis, and it worked.
Did you find other people did similar things?
Yeah, I did. I was thinking of William Styron, you know, who wrote Sophie's Choice, among other novels, and he would listen to classical music in the hours before he started writing in the evening, and he talked about how he needed that music to make himself feel exalted enough to face the act of composing. So I think there are quite a few writers who use music as a way to kind of get into the mood.
Thank you for calling us, Mindy. Catherine from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. I worked with the choreographer Eric Hawkins. He worked with Balanchine originally and then with Martha Graham. And, of course, in a dance studio, you have the ritual of going to class every day, and you're surrounded by fellow dancers. But what he would do that was unusual is after company class, which ended at 6 p.m., everyone would have dinner, and then we would come back for rehearsal, and that's when he would create work. We work continually probably for a few hours, and then he would work individually with people or with groups, and we would end up working until the sun came up the next morning, although many of us would just lie on our backs in the dressing room and wait to be called and doze off. But that was, he was a total night owl. I mean, he would show up at the studio 4:30 for company class, and then we would often work all night.
So if you wanted to dance with Eric Hawkins, you had to understand that you were not going to get much sleep during the night.
Yeah, or that you would you'd be the only one on the street in Manhattan early in the morning.
Thank you for calling us. In the book, you write about Twyla Tharp, who you say is an expert in daily routines. Hasn't she written a book about her own forming good habits?
Yeah, she has a very good book called The Creative Habit, in which she describes her own routine, which is the opposite. It's getting up very early in the morning. And for her, the ritual, it's not so much getting up in the morning. It's she says that it's the moment she steps outside and hails a cab to go to the gym, that sort of is the moment that her ritual kicks into gear, and that it's, there's something about not having to think about it, that once she's hailed the cab and she's said she's going to the gym, it sort of completes her morning ritual. And then she spends, I think, like 2 hours at the gym.
And Truman Capote is kind of the opposite of Twyla Tharp.
Truman Capote, he described himself as a completely horizontal author, and would start, on the couch and work his way into bed with the typewriter propped up on his knees. And as he worked, switch from tea to sherry to martinis.
But he also had a lot of superstitions. He would never allow more than 3 cigarette butts in 1 ashtray.
That's right. And he had numbers that he considered unlucky and wouldn't travel on dates that had an unlucky number or stay in hotel rooms that had an unlucky number.
So what happened when he had to dial somebody's telephone?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. I think some of these superstitions impeded his daily life.
My guest is Mason Curry. His book, Daily Rituals, How Artists Work. It's published by Knopf. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. And we are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. You can write us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. And a number of people have written in. John in New Jersey left a comment on our show page. He said, I'm a painter, writer, and musician, and all my life have never managed to create a ritual. I'm wondering if Mason has any suggestions for creating a ritual.
I think the key is to figure out what time of day is your best time to work. So undoubtedly, some people really can concentrate better first thing in the morning or late at night. Or, James Joyce said that his mind was at the best in the afternoon. But I think that most people have a time of day that is their kind of sweet spot, where they have a certain kind of brain power they don't have other times. And I think if you can figure that out and somehow block out some time at that day, that can be your routine.
Some people have no choice in the matter. You read about Joseph Heller, who had a day job.
Yeah, he worked.
And he had to sneak in his writing. Didn't he write Catch 22 in his spare time?
Yeah, he wrote Catch 22 in the evenings after work, sitting at the kitchen table. I think it took him 7 or 8 years. But even when he was able to quit working full time because Catch 22 was such a success, he still produced work at a snail's pace. And I think a lot of writers find that they really can only write for 2 or 3 hours a day. Really like good writing. And so it is possible to have a day job and write on the side. A lot of people get up early in the morning to make that happen.
In the case of T.S. Eliot, his friends were concerned that his job at the bank was preventing him from doing his work.
Yeah, and they even devised a scheme to kind of free him from the workaday world. They started a sort of collection, a sort of subscription service where people could contribute a yearly amount to give T.S. Eliot an income. And he found out about this and was horrified. He didn't want people's charity. And he actually found that the daily routine of a 9-to-5 job was good for him.
Well, a number of really creative people have worked at
at other jobs. Wallace Stevens wrote some of the greatest American poetry. William Carlos Williams was a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Charles Ives was probably the greatest American composer. And they all had jobs elsewhere. So it is possible.
Yeah, yeah. There were even some people in my book who didn't necessarily need to work but found that the schedule of a day job was good for them.
And there are some people who found it necessary to have other kinds of rituals that were like having a job, like putting on a suit and tie before they went to work.
Yeah, John Cheever kind of famously would put on a suit and tie and get on the elevator and ride down to the lobby with the other working people, but then would continue down to the basement where he would strip to his boxers and write until lunchtime.
Neil Friedman from Brooklyn left a comment on our show page. He writes, "My daily routine begins at 3:25 a.m. I wake up, put the kettle on low, and go into the still, dark living room where I sit and meditate for 40 minutes, after which I put on a CD of Buddhist chanting and do 30 minutes of stretching exercises. By then, the morning sky begins to brighten and the whistling kettle beckons me to make two French press pots of coffee, one for me and one for my wife."
That's very nice. That kind of reminds me of Beethoven, who believed that a cup of coffee should have exactly 60 coffee beans, and he would count them out one by one.
Let's take a call from, is it Barry?
Yes.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, this is really great. I'm so glad you're having this. I'm an illustrator, and my father was an illustrator, and my father always told me to leave the work unfinished when you're done, and then the next day you're not looking at a blank piece of paper. You're coming back to what you had left unfinished the night before. And the other thing that he did was, before he had to work, he always rearranged the furniture in his workroom. It got him going somehow. So those are my two things.
Thank you for calling us.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
And the interesting thing is that that's not all that eccentric. You've had a lot of stories like that.
Yeah, that's not too eccentric. And actually, the comment about leaving something on the paper so that you didn't have to face the blank page is one that comes up a few times in the book. Hemingway spoke often about the importance of kind of leaving it when you know what comes next, and so you don't have to, so you sort of have this thread that you can pick up the next morning.
But there are other writers like Michael Ondaatje who say that they want to start off every day with a blank mind, and then they just start writing, and it's only after they've put together a lot of pages that they look through them and figure out what the heck they're thinking about and what the book is going to be like.
Yeah. I mean, I think the one thing the book makes clear is that there is no one way to do it, and that there's sort of all these different personalities and behaviors can work. It's whatever works, you know.
Another listener, Alexandra from Astoria, left a comment on our show page. She writes, "My early morning writing schedule will be disrupted this summer as my daughter's school ends and Camp Mommy takes effect. Any ideas without waking up too early, since I am the primary caregiver and don't believe in the nanny culture to raise my child, refuse to plop her in front of the TV?"
That's a tough one. I think that, you know, there are quite a few people in the book who were juggling creative work with caring for their families or day jobs. Alice Munro wrote stories for her first story collection over the period of several years while she was taking care of her kids. And she says that she was very big on naps in those years. I don't know if the writer's kids are too old for naps, but I think that you do probably have to find something.
Go to sleep, my little darling. I want to write. Yeah, Roz Chass, the cartoonist, says that what she does, because she works in the house, is she puts on her coat and she says to her daughter, "Okay, mommy's going to go to work now." She leaves the front door, goes to the back, goes upstairs to her workroom.
That's fascinating.
Otherwise, the kid would know that she's there and she would be disrupted constantly.
Right.
I'm going to sneak one more call in here. Wayne from Bayonne, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello, Leonard. How are you?
I'm well.
Hey. I was telling your screener that one of my rituals is I make sure my apartment's up. I write comic books, right, and illustrate comic books and movie scripts and stuff.
Are you going to kill off Superman again?
What is it?
You're going to kill off Superman again?
Well, actually, my comic book has Stephen Colbert in outer space, basically. I work with that with those guys over there. I basically, my ritual is I get up in the morning, I clean my apartment, take a shower, and eat and do whatever. And then I turn on WNYC, believe it or not, for the rest of the day in the background in the other room low that I can't really hear it. But it just makes it sound like there's somebody in the building with me because I spend so many hours alone. I want to make sure that I don't lose my mind in the silence. You know what I'm saying? As I'm pulling ideas out of my mind. I just did a thing called the Dick Orbit Show. That's the comic book. I want to send you guys a couple after this is over.
And how soon after you do all of this do the ideas start flowing?
It takes about 20 minutes. Well, again, I turn my computer on, and once I get into a relaxed, I've been an artist my whole life for about 30, 40 years now, professionally. And a writer. I did stand up and different things like that. And it takes about 20 minutes. And that your speaker was correct too. You only get about two or three good hours of the. I'm working on a novel right now, kind of like a Bukowski, comedy novel. And it takes. I get about two good. In the old days, I used to be able to go like 12, 20 hours to illustrate things or whatever. Now these days to write, as I'm getting older, I only could get a good 2 or 3 hours, usually about 2-3 o'clock, and then after that, I want to go take a nap.
Thank you for calling us. Now that's one approach. You write about Stephen King, who has a word count that he goes for.
Yeah, I think it's 2,000 words, and he says sometimes he can get it done, by noon, and other days he's got to keep at it until late afternoon, and. I the caller mentioned listening to the radio while working, and in addition to finding a lot of material in books, I also interviewed several contemporary artists, and the painter Chuck Close told me about how he likes to paint with the radio on in the background, and that he felt like he got a lot of his best painting done during scandals, during the Lewinsky affair and other kind of big newsy scandals. That kind of juicy radio material was his best background listening.
Mason Curry's book is called Daily Rituals, How Artists Work. It's published by Knopf. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.